This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. It's an extraordinary honor for us, and it's a gift to have your presence. We're deeply grateful for all that you do and all that you are. For those of you who are new to Slot, we're a volunteer organization. For over 17 years, we've worked in collaboration with communities and institutions at the intersection of the arts and humanities, public culture, and social justice. Our mission is to facilitate dialogue about the urgent social and cultural issues of our times and to advocate for the power of the arts as we collectively engage in the essential and ongoing work of protest and resistance. We believe ardently in the power of dialogue to drive cultural change, and the importance of discovering ourselves in others. One example of our work is this exhibition that you have around you. This exhibition features the work of Active Stills, a photographic collective of Israeli and Palestinian photographers. Their work documents colonialist segregation and separation strategies in Israel against the Palestinian population. The separation strategies that this exhibition documents includes land dispossession, house demolitions, relocations, forced removals, movement restrictions, and economic exploitation. You can learn more about this exhibition and our work at Slot on our website, slot.org. You can also access there an extensive audio archive of past programs that we've recorded. We will be recording tonight's program where appropriate, so we ask that you silence your cell phones as well. So the program tonight is also part of Slot's and Penn's Social Justice and Arts Integration Initiative. Some of you may have already attended past programs this year. We launched last November with a retrospective of the work of Louverture Films, a film production company that Danny Glover had founded together with Jocelyn Barnes about 10 years ago. Louverture Films takes its name from the leader of the Haitian Revolution, Toussaint Louverture, who was famous for always creating an opening in the face of enormous obstacles. The retrospective of Louverture Films recently concluded. The work continues, inspired by the conviction that the arts are absolutely indispensable, but they're also an indispensable method of imagining justice and making democracy. Through public programs such as tonight's program, we seek to elevate histories and stories of the struggle for justice here in Philadelphia and beyond. We take our departure in all of this work from the extraordinary work and life of W.E.B. Du Bois, who was this incredibly world historical figure whose groundbreaking work began here with the Philadelphia Negro. He went on to nearly a century of extraordinary reimaginings of the conditions for the possibility of freedom and justice, particularly for people of color. In his seminal, The Soul of Black Folks, Du Bois poses two questions that have grounded our work this past year and the work of the initiative, especially in our appreciation of real-world suffering and the demands for justice that places on all of us. How does it feel to be a problem, and what must be done? At once analytic, deeply empathetic, and visionary, Du Bois's questions serve as a call to all of us to let suffering speak and to realize justice for all. So tonight's program, Public Lands, Private Hands, takes the form, as all of you know, of a gathering of Native American tribal leaders and community activists from the Utah Diné Bikaya and the Mountain Ute, Hopi, Navajo, Acoma, and Delaware tribes, all speaking about the status of Bears Ears National Monument and their relationship with their sacred lands. I'd like to just very quickly acknowledge the photographer Fazl Sheikh, and although I know that he wishes to remain in the background tonight, he is here with us, and his recent project's Exposures, of which a copy is available, documents the ruination of the Utah landscape by uranium mining, by oil and gas extraction, and by the militarization of the desert. Fazl's work traces a long history of exploration, and settlement, debates over the privatization of public lands for resource extraction, and the consequences, the costly consequences of all of this on the native communities and their wondrous landscape.
Fazel was invited to teach a course at Princeton this past semester. As part of that course, he brought the students that he was teaching and working with, learning from as well, I'm sure, to Utah to engage the tribal leaders and community activists, many of whom are here tonight. They were then invited to Princeton, where for the last 2 days they have presented and participated in a number of public programs. They were all incredibly generous in extending their stay and traveling to Philadelphia to be with us this evening. So thank you again to all of you for all that you have done to be here tonight. I'd like to now turn to Angelo Baca. Angelo is a cultural resource coordinator at the Utah Dine Bikeya and a PhD candidate in anthropology at New York University. He's going to orient all of us about media and provide us with an orientation to cultural sensitivity.
Thank you very much for being here, everyone. Hello, I'm Angelo. I'll introduce myself more in depth later, but I really wanted to point out this media orientation and cultural sensitivity guide. We often preface before these events what would be culturally appropriate and follow certain protocols that have to do with image capturing and storytelling, talking about images, audio, film, video, that kind of thing. So we're just going to ask in general, right now from the outset, to be cognizant of that and pay attention to the fact that we prefer that you not record the opening prayers or the closing prayers. So no audio or video or photography on that point. But I would like to point you to the reporter guidelines in particular, because those are helpful tips for you, especially with our community members regarding elders and young people about some better practices for interaction. So we're trying to limit the stereotypical usual tropes that we often encounter, improve narratives, better interactions, and make good working partnerships and positive, productive relationships. So let's try to take some of these tips that are within the guide. Other than that, we really welcome that people, you know, take part in this and participate with, you know, having the event something that they want to remember, but in the right ways. So that's just wanted to point that out to you, and then you can take these are free, and we have more materials at the front that'll be helpful and informative as well.
I'd like to now invite Jonah Yellowman, Utah Dine Bikeya Spiritual Advisor on the Board of Directors, to come and offer the opening prayer. We are deeply honored to have Curtis Zuniga, Director of Cultural Resources for the Delaware Tribe, someone who has deep, deep ties to these lands that we stand on, and he will be offering a land statement.
Good evening, friends. It's my honor and privilege to be here. And before I make this statement, real quick, I want to acknowledge a couple people, three people that came here to visit tonight, friends that I've made in the past year, working through the University of Pennsylvania. Pauline and Stephanie are here at my invitation. I'm glad you're here. Stephanie is also Dene, and so I hope that prayer was like nourishment to your cultural spirit to hear those words. And can you stand up real quick? For all my Navajo friends here, come by and visit this lady and say hello, because she's working at UPenn here. So anyway, I appreciate you ladies being here. And then also way in the back, Will Fenton from the Library Company of Philadelphia. And he and I are working on a project called Rewriting History. It tells the story of the Paxton Wars of the 1750s right here in this area right here. It's a fascinating book done in graphic novel style that'll be coming out here at the end of this year. Fascinating project, and I'm honored to be a part of that. So I just wanted to give you all a little shout out real quick. So I am Curtis Zuniga. I am an enrolled member of the Delaware Tribe of Indians. Delaware is our English name. Our name in our language is Lenape. Lenape, the original people. So many of you local folks, you know about that name. You may have heard it spoken as Lenape. It's Lenape. But regardless, we are we acknowledge, I'm acknowledging on your behalf, and I want you to acknowledge that we are indeed standing on original Lenape land. This is the indigenous lands of the Lenape people. Our homeland extended from, I've said this before, kind of like where the foothills of the Catskill Mountains end in upstate New York. If you go any further north, you're in Haudenosaunee country. But then you go south, you're going through Manhattan, all the way down here to Philadelphia, all the way down about to Wilmington, Delaware, all of New Jersey, eastern half of Pennsylvania. As you know, you folks from Philadelphia, I hope you know and you've seen that big statue of Tamanin. He was the one, by legend, is to be the one who treated with William Penn that ultimately provided the land to become the Pennsylvania colony, city of Philadelphia. So that's a very iconic image, and I hope the folks that are going to take a tour of Philadelphia tomorrow will go see that. That's just as impacting as seeing a statue of William Penn or, you know, Benjamin Franklin or like that kind of thing, at least from my perspective. And yet, that's the original homeland. And people like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, when they were here in this city, they coveted a relationship with the Lenape, the original people of the land, because they controlled the Lenape, they controlled the actions of the native people in all of this area where this whole experiment of these colonies coming together to ultimately become the United States of America. And on September 17th of 1778, the Treaty of Fort Pitt was the first Indian treaty that the United States of America ever entered in. They used the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. One of the first powers of Congress was to regulate commerce among the foreign nations, the several states, and the Indian tribes. Yes, they put the Indian tribes on the same legal and political level as foreign nations and the states. The first treaty this country signed was with France. The second treaty they ever signed, and the first Indian treaty, was with the Delaware. And can you believe in that treaty? They actually promised the creation of a Indian state with the Delawares at the head of that state. That's written into that treaty. There was almost a 14 star in the American flag, and that was going to be the Indian state with the Delawares at the head of it. But our legacy is this. All of those promises in treaties were forgotten, ignored, and after we helped the Americans, we moved from neutrality to siding with the Americans against the British. After the war was won, we were told to leave. Every time we provided accommodation, as the elders, the grandfathers, the peacekeepers, every time we provided accommodation to the Europeans and to the Americans, we were thanked until they got what they wanted, and then they didn't want us anymore. My tribe is in Oklahoma. I'm one of many bands of Delaware who have endured a diaspora across the United States. We have two bands in Oklahoma, two bands in Ontario, Canada. We're like separate branches from the same tree trunk. But I want to use the analogy that I feel this when I come back here. I feel this when I was at Princeton yesterday, Philadelphia, or I go to New York City. I feel like I'm back in the homeland, back in that homeland where our people originated. It's like I feel like I'm an orphan that was taken away from my mother, and now I get to come back and be with my mother back home. That's what we want. And I say that because I now want to go beyond just land acknowledgement. And this is a call to action for finding a way to achieve land equity and make up for all this that's happened for the last 250 years. And I'm not talking about run all the white people out of here, but I'm talking about being welcomed back in our home. I'm talking about being given a place at the table and made to feel welcome and finding a way for our people to come back to our home and feel like we're back with our mother, because we have that, I call it blood memory. It's in our DNA. We know we feel this when we're at the rivers, when we're traversing upon the lands. We know we feel that. And I call upon each and every one of you in your own way, even if it's through your prayers, that this might happen. That the great institutions of power, whether they be academic, government, religion, that all of those people that have great power here in our original homeland find a way of opening their hearts and their minds and their homes and, yes, their pocketbooks and welcome us back here. I promise you that we will be gracious family members when we come home to be with our mother. I give great respect to this assembly and to the speakers that you're going to hear. And I am grateful for the privilege of standing before you and giving this land acknowledgement statement. And I hope to converse with you in the days and weeks and months to come about this very issue that I brought up. And with that, in the language of our people, the Lenape, our word for thank you is Wanishi.
We're incredibly pleased to have Jaskiran Dillon joining us tonight as the moderator for the discussion. She's a first-generation anti-colonial scholar, the co-editor of the forthcoming Standing with Standing Rock, the author of Prairie Rising, Indigenous Youth, Decolonization, and the Politics of Intervention. And she's also an associate professor of global studies and anthropology at the New School. Jaskiran grew up on Treaty 6 Cree territory in Saskatchewan, Canada. She's deeply committed to organizing, to social movements for justice, for Indigenous sovereignty, and for the protection of tribal lands. And she will be providing tonight context on all of these issues and urgencies. Jaskiran will be joined by Gavin Noyes, who will be providing historical background to the political struggle over Bears Ears. Gavin is the executive director of Utah Diné Bikaya. He holds degrees in natural resources and public policy. He studied ceramic arts in Japan, and he's worked with tribes in the Southwest for more than 10 years. He has experience in land planning, in grassroots organizing, and in facilitation. So please join me in thanking and inviting and joining Jaskiran and Gavin to the stage. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's an honor to be here in the presence of so many incredible leaders from all over. And it's not often enough here in Philadelphia and many cities in the Northeast, for that matter, that we have the gift to learn from land defenders, Indigenous land defenders, and water protectors. So this feels like an important and noteworthy gathering tonight. So as Aaron mentioned, Gavin and I are going to offer just a few words before the rest of the program for tonight gets going. And before I speak, I just want to locate myself. So I'm speaking tonight as a settler of color, the daughter of immigrant parents from northern India who grew up on Treaty 6 Korean Métis territory in what is now known as Saskatchewan, Canada, here on Turtle Island. So we live in a moment, historical moment, marked by grave uncertainty about the fate of planet Earth. Our children and grandchildren are inheriting a world almost singularly defined by climate change. Temperatures are rising, oceans are experiencing acidification, Arctic polar ice caps are melting faster than they should be, small island states are being swallowed up by rising sea levels. And in the midst of this planet-wide movement, where communities all over the globe are thinking deeply about what our collective future will look like, Indigenous peoples and their long-standing resistance to environmental devastation are clear signposts of who should be guiding us into the future. Indeed, here in what is now known as the United States, they have been fighting environmental devastation and injustice since 1492. So when we listen to the presenters tonight, who are speaking specifically to the political struggle for land and life at Bears Ears, which Gavin will provide historical context for in a minute, it is important to remember that the United States is a settler colony. It is a country that was built through indigenous land dispossession and immense colonial violence, through the translation and commodification of land into private property, and through a reliance on what we now know as natural resources as a way to fuel the acceleration and sustenance of racial capitalism. The sense of time that often animates how liberal environmentalists think about environmental concerns are distinct from the sense of time experienced by indigenous peoples who have had to survive environmental catastrophe since the initiation of the colonial project. From the vantage point of indigenous resistance, the environmental crisis is coextensive with the time of colonialism. So in addition to what we hear tonight about the specific struggle at Bears Ears, we will also see how the fight for environmental justice is a struggle for indigenous sovereignty, a struggle for indigenous land reclamation. The colonial violence that has fostered the ruination of the planet in the first place has been, for the most part, blurred out of focus in much of the public dialogue when we talk about and hear about environmental injustice. And an accurate examination of the social and political causes of climate change requires looking closely at the history of genocide, land dispossession, and the concerted destruction of indigenous societies and cultural practices and governance systems that has come alongside the irreversible damage wrought by the environmental destruction that we see in our world. And I'm really confident that our presenters tonight will enable us to understand all of this much better. So Gavin's now going to provide all of us with some historical context for the struggle at Bears Ears.
Thank you so much for that. And I think that's a perfect way of framing our speakers that are coming next. And what I want to invite people to do is, again, escape the reality that we're in right now and think back what this place was. I want to especially thank Curtis for providing that Lenape perspective on these lands, these indigenous lands that we stand on. I also want to thank Slot for inviting us here tonight. And I want to thank Fuzzle, all the students from Princeton, and the amazing experience that we've had here. And what I'm going to do in the next couple minutes is describe the place of Bears Ears and the people who share ancestral ties there, the indigenous people of Bears Ears. And I'm going to start, I'm the executive director of Utah Dene Bekea, and we have an all Native American board. I am not indigenous myself to these lands. I descend from Sweden and Britain primarily, but my role here has been, I've had the tremendous opportunity to get to learn and realize that the wisdom of the people that you are going to get to hear from next is profound. These are the stewards of our continent. And if we can't learn to listen to the things that they've learned over the millennia, then I think that the challenges and the ways of knowing this land are going to be lost on us forever. I believe you all have this brochure, which has a handy map on the back. And to provide this space of Bears Ears, this dark boundary here is the 1.9 million acre boundary created by President Obama in 2016. And these tiny red hatched boundaries are what's left after Trump dismembered it in December 2017. But to describe this place, it is the last frontier that was never conquered by colonists. It sits precisely 5 hours away from Salt Lake City, from Denver, from Albuquerque, and from Phoenix. It is geologically protected. It has a huge 2,000-foot barrier on the east side. It's got the Colorado River on the northwest side, and it's got the San Juan River to the south. And so it has always been naturally protected. And not only that is that we have about 24 tribes who have lived and have their origin stories in this place of Bears Ears. It is ecologically intact, and the tribes with ties to it are culturally intact. And so this national monument was created through the elders who share ties to the willows, the sumac, the foods, the wildlife, the rocks, the minerals, the places that are all non-human relatives to these cultures in this space. And so for the creation of this national monument, it is actually a tribute to the indigenous people of our country. And at Utah Dene Bekea, we believe that this is not a wilderness setting, but it's a place that needs to be reactivated through the indigenous people whose origins come from it. And by rebuilding and strengthening those relationships, the place will thrive, and in turn, the indigenous people will thrive. And so this space is an opportunity to finally learn and finally listen to people like those who are going to be up here on stage tonight, and to see what a management plan looks like that's written from the indigenous perspective. We have never attempted to do that before, and it's a perfect space for this. But I also want to provide the political context for what has happened here. Our board of directors worked with each of the 10 Native American communities in San Juan County. San Juan County has a slight majority of Native American people. And it's 51% Native. Native Americans live in the south. White people live in the north. And the white folks predominantly live in two towns. And they're all descendants of Mormon pioneers who have settled the state of Utah and a bit beyond. And so from the get-go, our organization has built this through our leaders on a strong traditional spiritual foundation through the tribes that they're members of. Similarly, Mormons also share a strong spiritual foundation in their beliefs. And early on, they were very open to protecting a space for those spiritual reasons. But eventually, once the size of it was proposed and different dynamics came to play, they started fighting it. And it became, to them, about power. To the tribes, it's never been about power. It's been about having a space to teach, having a space to be seen, having a place at the table. And the many things that have happened since then are that Congress couldn't get this done. It was a bill that could have moved forward collaboratively, but we have Anglos in the county that have very little awareness of the priorities and the perspectives of their Native American neighbors. And so several dynamics happened where it became impossible to get consensus within the county, and then the state of Utah began as a whole fighting the Bears Ears National Monument proposal. President Obama stepped in and did create it. He set aside 1.3 million acres, but he did it after Trump got elected. And so it was in the final 3 weeks of his office, and as soon as everyone saw that Trump was in office, the Utah delegation really started sharpening their swords to take away some or all of the monument. And they actually threatened 28 different monuments across the country. So far, they've only taken away two of them. They dismembered Bears Ears by about 90%, and they also took away 1 million acres from Grand Staircase National Monument in Utah. that context is where we're at. We have filed litigation. We're one of a couple dozen organizations that have sued. We are working under and on behalf of the five tribes of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. They are the sovereign entities that got this designation in place, and we are assisting them through the community level. The other dynamic that I'm honored to have, Willie holding this map here, the Navajo Nation sued the state of Utah about 2 years ago over racial gerrymandering of San Juan County. It's a majority county, and they have cracked and packed the Native community into one single district. They pack them all in here and then split up two tiny groups in the other two of the three districts. The federal judge decided last year, or about a year and a half ago, that this was illegal discrimination that is not allowed. And through a series of events, the election districts got redrawn, and two majority Native American districts were the result. One of those was very heavily Native American. The other one was pretty evenly split between Anglos and Native Americans, which are almost perfectly split between Republicans and Democrats. And Willie Gray Eyes threw his hat in the ring. And for the first time in Utah history, Willie was elected last November, creating a majority Native American county commission, which gives the 10 Native communities in San Juan County the opportunity for the first time to have their voices heard. This is a county where 40% of the Native Americans have no running water, no electricity. They've had to sue for every gain that they've ever gotten in the county, from voting rights was the first one, schools, education. I think the Navajo have won eight lawsuits in a row in San Juan County. So this is a place in our country that has had some of the most unfair practices against a minority community who's actually the majority community. And so we're going to be hearing stories about that. And you can refer to this map when people are talking about their communities, because this is the only map you will find out there that actually has the names of their communities on it, because they've not been published on other maps. And so that is the context for tonight. And again, please open your minds and your hearts to trying to understand what this part of our country is like, and trying to wrap your head around the question of, why is it still like this? How can we move beyond these kinds of racial and environmental justice issues and create a place that is fair and equitable for all? So thank you very much.
So I'd like to invite up Aldine Ketchum, who is Ute and a bear dance chief, and he's going to offer a musical piece.
Mike. Nina Nunia, Panachta Kakwanet. Na ah we knew to die Mabat move we knew to me at Pagaproy, then with the whip got up, my queer got in the cavity, Nian got it's right. Hello. My name is Lightning Hawk, but my English name is Aldine Ketchum. And I'm from the Nooch, the Ute tribe. Ute Mountain, Ute Band, and my people, we live and still live on a base in the shadows of Bear's Ears. I grew up there as a kid. My family utilized the land and became one with it, and we knew that the land was important to us, so therefore we took care of it and respected it, and in return, it respected us. So, my grandfather, Billy Mike, his English name, but his Ute name was Jijij, he taught me how to make this flute, give it a voice, of the cedar wood. As a kid growing up, I found a baby red-tailed hawk, and I raised him up and sent him back into the wild and where he belongs. But he one day found me and gave me his tail feather. I don't know if you can see it. The red-tailed hawk. And so my name, say, became of that. My grandfather, he said, so your name is going to be Lightning Hawk. The flute is a healing instrument. It heals the inner spirit where healing must begin. It heals all living things, the humans, the animals. I witnessed this. So I come before you to share this song that I made for my friend, Evan Cardam, on the flute here. So this is his song. This flute I have in my hand here is native to this part of the country. It's made out of the bird's eye maple tree. And years ago, I was asked to participate in an event that honored all Native people. And I was asked to open the ceremony. And it was during the 2002 Winter Olympics. And as a matter of fact, the whole world saw this flute. And the song they had us play at this event is talking about the people, the Nooch, how we are still existing, surviving. So the word Nooch means the people, as other indigenous tribes refer to themselves in their own language, as a people. So this is a song I played called We Are the People, much like our Constitution states. Now this instrument that I have in my hand here is one that we call the Winnetahornup, the growler. And this dance has been with my people for hundreds of years, maybe thousands. And it this dance was given to us by the bear. It is said that in return, the bear said, always honor me and remember me. And of all things, it was a lady bear that taught this dance to my people. So in return, we call it the Mamakorn of the ladies' dance. So the women get to pick and choose their partners. We do this at the beginning of spring each year. And it runs throughout the whole summer months. It starts up in the northern part of Utah where the Uinta Ori band, my people live, the same tribe, same band, different bands, I mean. We just live in different areas. They started off there, as a matter of fact, last week. And there's another one there this weekend. And so thus it travels through all the Nooch communities. It goes into Colorado. They have a couple of bear dances there. Then finally, it travels back into Utah. We get to have the last bear dance on Labor Day weekend. We send the bear back to his deep winter sleep. So this song is talking about the lady bear. She had come to dance. You could hear her rustling in the bushes, headed this way. The song states, the lady bear goes on, is looking at me, staring at me. And I said, well, let's dance then. And in the end, there she is standing with tears in her eye because it's the last dance and the dance is over. So we do this for 4 days, and on the last day we have a big feast. We feed everybody to come out and help us dance. So I've been a bear dance chief for 30 years now. Although I don't look that young. But my grandparents, my grandpas, they lived well over 100 years old. And it's because of the land, it provides us with nourishment, with healing power. I'm getting so nervous, sorry. I'm used to dry country. Oh, it's kind of like a humidifier. I share this music with you and even invite you out one of these days to our bear dance, Labor Day weekend. Put it in your future calendar and I invite you as a bear dance chief. I always tease my family, tell them, you better do what I say, I'm the chief for 4 days. Okay, okay. After that, because we are the chiefs. Okay, it works. So this is a healing dance that the people do. They dance for those that cannot walk and those that are sick. They dance and leave all their problems and burdens right there on the arena, which is in a circular part of our construction of the dance arena. It is lined with the branches of the cedar trees pointing up toward the heavens. Because we as Native people, we don't worship any animals or birds. We just merely use their knowledge of the land. In return, we respected them with songs and dances. And so I come before you to share this song with you. And it'll be in Ute. The first 2 days, the people form a line going from north to south. The guys face towards the east. The women face towards the west. So the four directions are in balance. On the third day, they break into pairs. And dance the length of the arbor in reference of the respect for the women. Because when you're going backwards, and you can't see behind you, but your partner can. So you're maneuvering through other partners. And so it's an endurance dance, like aerobics. As a matter of fact, the last dance sometimes lasts over an hour. Can you guys dance a whole hour? Some do. The landscape is still there. And he'll always be there when you're all gone. So we, this is, you can't really hear it, right? So we would amplify the sound. This would represent a box, a wooden box, and it's our drum. So if I place this instrument on here, it sounds like a bear. It also mimics the sound of the thunder to waken the bear. It's been a wonderful experience coming out to this end of the world. You know, it's kind of ironic. On a flight over here, I was watching a show called Aquaman. And as a kid, I used to read Aquaman comic book. That's how I learned how to read and write. Because English is a second language for me. So excuse me if I stumble and have a broken English. I am honored to be here, and especially going out to the ocean and after seeing Aquaman, I'm like, I wonder if there is Atlantis here. And I hope I see the princess come up now. I am honored to be here again to let you know that we as Nuuch people still exist in this Pueratenakawit, as we call it in our language. Many sacred sites around there of the ancient ones that lived long ago, who was given the name Winuuch, and then Mukwich, the older youth. So the Hopi retained that name, Mukwich. And thus it is the way we respect the land, the animals. Because what we do to them will affect us in the long run. So we must educate our kids about the knowledge of the power of education that was given to us in a form of harsh knowledge of being taken from your family and forced to know and understand a language that was foreign to us. And But yet we took and became strong. And so I stand before you in my regalia that my people would worn back around the introduction of European culture and the clothing that I have here is, I'd say, summer wear, because we traded with the Europeans of cloth. It was the mountain men that came and to our area and learned our ways. And so again, Royak, thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that with us, Aldine. So next up, we have a panel of community leaders, and this discussion will be moderated by Angelo Baca, the Cultural Resources Coordinator at Utah Dine Bekea and PhD candidate in anthropology at New York University.
Good evening, everyone. How's everyone doing? All right. Good. You're still with us. It's a lot of people in a small space. You sure you're okay? So I'm going to invite our panelists to come up here and join me. So Evangeline Gray, Ida Yellowman, Tara Benali, and Ajani Yepa. So I want to give a little bit of background on these guys, on these wonderful women who are land advocates, representatives, community members, outspoken representatives who are wonderful at what they do in each of the different parts of the Bears Ears surrounding communities. And so for us, it's a little bit of a ways from home. We're kind of feeling maybe a little homesick even for a couple days. But this has been a wonderful experience to actually come across the country and share a lot about the challenges, but also the successes of our communities in the struggle to protect our own lands. So for us, we're always trying to be advocates, educators, representatives, and to always put forth the best parts of why we want to protect our land, our language, our culture, and our people. So let's start right now with Evangi, because I feel like Evangi is the one who comes from the community of Westwater, and the community of Westwater is probably the closest community of Navajo folks right next to the Bears Ears National Monument. And this has been continuously a challenging space to get electricity and water and accurate and fair representation. And so they've always had to go through many different hoops, both on the local level, on the state level, and the national level. And I feel like Evangi has been continuously positive. She's been always good with trying to be outspoken and get that attention to the issues that they deserve. And so let's ask Evangi, why is Bears Ears an important part of your life, being from Westwater and speaking up about its protection?
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Evangeline Gray. I come from four different tribes. I come from the Diné tribe, the Navajo tribe. I also come from the Ute tribe with Aldine's part of his relation. And I also come from the Apache of Mescalero. I also come from Comanche tribe of Oklahoma. Thank you for being here. My clan is Bitani, only one clan. And I'd like to answer that question because Bear Ears is where my father was born. That's where his father was born. That's where his mother was born. That's where the mother, the great-grandmother is born. The great-grandmother is the sister of Chief Melito. He was the chief that was well-known in the Navajo, among the Navajo people. And he's the one that helped our tribal people to come home after taking a roundup or for a long walk towards Oklahoma, where they placed a lot of Native American people. And because of that, I felt like that I needed to voice my voice And where I come from is, I have 29 family that I oversee in a small community close to Bear Ears. And a lot of my family there, my relation, they don't have any water, electricity, any modern facility. And as I came home about 25 years ago, all I seen was small, tiny, square, little, almost like a shed. Well, they were shed houses. And there were my elderlies were living in there. And where there was a small, tiny hokan, there was two of the elderly men, brothers, that were living in there. And then there was others, like a trailer run down, really old, and they had seven children in there with their parents, and you know, it goes on. And the area had no road to it. I mean, there was a road to it, but when it got muddy, it was so muddy that the kids were walking about a fourth of a mile to the bus stop to get on that bus. But in 1968, we had our tribe paying the county for the road, which was never done. So when I came back, I started researching why. And then once we started it, threatened to do lawsuit against the county. They say it belongs to the state, and you know how this goes. It belongs to the town of Blanding. But in the long run, they started it about 3 years ago. We finally started to have some gravel road and all into our community. And about 15 years ago, I started that community, started building houses with the trust fund that we get just a little bit of it from the oil and gas royalty. Just so little percent of it. And also I started going on internet, and I got some other people to help us that were willing to make this place houses. So far we got 18 houses for 29 people, but still we still don't have electricity and water. So I've been at 25 years ago, I came home to that area, and I've been going to Town Up Landing, which is just about a mile across from where we live. There's a canyon, and we live on the side of the hill, and then right across you see mansions and triple road. It's like four-lane road with a small community. And they have electricity, everything you name it. They have school, they have bus that stops right in front of their houses, but not our house, our home. So finally, after making that gravel road, the kids starting to walk from their homes to the highway, the nearest highway, to get on the bus without getting muddy shoes or, you know, all that. So anyway, I continued trying to negotiate with the county, the mayor, the state, the federal, why can't we get water? And their excuse was really not answered. But what they wanted 12 years ago was, if you build a bridge from to that town to your little Navajo, then the reservation. And that's their excuse was, you guys live on the reservation. We really have nothing to do with you guys. You go to your tribe to get your resources. But in return, 12 years ago, they said, if you build that bridge, that time was $1.5 million. If you do that, maybe we can put a electricity and water sewer line underneath that bridge to go to your homes. And my people are uneducated, and just a few of them are getting to educate themselves. And 4 years ago, all this time, you know, we could not provide the bridge. So it's just there. We can't afford a bridge. But then 4 years ago, what I did not know was that they were selling the where our reservation is, behind, they were giving up land at $3,000 an acre. 2,000 an acre. It was almost like auctioning it off. And they wanted us to build this bridge for them so they can get the electricity behind our reservation. That's my conclusion. The other thing is protecting the barriers going back to my family. That's my ancestral land. That's where I come from. And I know the stories. I grew up in those canyons when I was a little girl before I was taken to government school at the age of 3 years old. When I came home, we would go to the mountain where Bear Ears is at, and we go and hunt turkey, bear, elk, deer. We would have fun as a family, and that was our main source of hunting, our meal, our food, and then we would go to pick up our herbal from there for healing, then also to put them as seasoning inside our meat, our food, you know, season them. And, you know, they taste like regular seasoning with food. So because of that, it's really dear to me that we protect this Bear Ears. And when Mr. Mark Maryboy and Willie Gray Eyes, they were the first two individuals that were trying to get different community. There's 7 community in state of Utah, different community. They're called chapter houses, and they were trying to get individual person to be on that committee because I was vocal against the town of Blanding State. So I got on the board, and every month we would have a meeting, how we're going to do this, how we're going to get this creation of this monument. We fought with so much advertisement. We got Kevin Knoll to come on 10 years ago. Oh my gosh, he's such a wonderful asset to our making this as a national monument. When it became a national monument, well, let me go back. So every month we would meet, and I would go back and tell my community, this is what we're going to do. We're doing this, you know, with that national monument. And oh, my family were, my community were uproar, and they said, we'll support you. You're the one that's educated for us. You're the one that will be our voice. So I continued, and when it became a national monument, some of my elderlies, they cried, and they said, oh my gosh, we can go hunting. We can almost move back. We can, you know, go hunting. One thing they required of me was, let us as community close to that national monument, let us be at free will, not to have licensure to go hunting. Let us go hunting any time of the year when we need to go hunting. We knew when the deer, the elk, all the wildlife, we knew when they were pregnant, when they were going to give birth. That's when we don't go hunting. We knew all this nature. So we would go hunting only on certain time of the year for certain animals. Same with the plants. So that was, you know, that was their voice for me to put it on the table with other community as if it when it became a national monument. I thought that was going to be my first voice for me to give, so that we, in the contract or with the lease or whatever the government, that was my hopes and dream for my community. But it was for 1 year. We were all excited. I started writing, what else do you guys need? What else shall we put in? And we drew a lot of stuff on what they wanted, and what, pick up woods for our winter because we don't have electricity at our home to have it heat during the winter months. Let's go out to pick up woods anytime we want. We had so much stuff in order for my community, but when Trump went and shrank it, we cried because we knew that we won't be there anymore. I couldn't be their voice no more. Now there's, is it 11 community committees member now that are designing how they're going, well, they already did, they already designed how they can manage the national monument. So that's my story.
Thank you. And thank you, Vanji, very much for sharing all of that. And I wanted to point out on your maps that the community of Westwater is the one that's just west of Blanding, between Blanding and the monument. So they're right there. And in fact, you'll be seeing pictures of it. You'll see the little houses in the background, and then the Bears Ears are in back of that. So that's really how close these folks are. And yet, so many of the infrastructure needs are not met, even though it could easily be done. And in fact, they were supposed to have been done. But all these years and, you know, litigation have been slowing down the process of getting these community members exactly what they need. And so I wanted to point out also that, you know, some of her background in the clanship relationship is tied to Bears Ears. And many of us who have our clan system, we identify ourselves that way. And that ties us to a larger network, a kinship of relatives, and sometimes even to these places like Bears Ears. So I would say to introduce myself, Angelo Baca Yeneshe, Flash Titanishle, Kis Ani Bashishin, Twadachiti Dasheche, Nakai Dinee Dashanella. So I'm Navajo and Hopi, and I have kind of a unique situation with that because I have two different cultures that actually have a claim to this place. So I'm from San Juan County. I grew up there, and on both of my sides of my family, that's really coming out of Bears Ears. So I feel really lucky to be in this position, and I feel really lucky to work with these community members because, in a way, we are family, whether we're close or we're just related through clan. Like, Tara here is technically my daughter. So she always freaks me out. She comes up to me. She's like, hey, Dad. And then, of course, my mother. And so my mother here is Ida Yellowman. She's a nurse. She's a uranium mining nurse who treats the patients who have been impacted by these extractive industries that have destroyed our landscape and our bodies. So it's a very difficult job to have. It's a very burdensome work to shoulder every single day. And I know that's one of the reasons that we want also protection for this landscape. So with that context, I wanted to ask her about being a uranium nurse and knowing many of these elders, sometimes traveling hundreds of miles to see them, but also knowing the culture and the language. What are some of those obstacles that you encounter seeing the impacts of uranium poisoning upon our people, and also the limited access of water and electricity impacting our health?
Do I have 3 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. It's the only time you'll tell me that.
This is technically on here.
So my name is Ida Yellowman. Tlashchin nishlon torijin ibashishchin hanagani dashinale ashin dashache. So that's where I come from. My mother, my father, my grandparents on both sides of my mom and my dad. And those clans go all the way back to the beginning. And because I know who I am, I know where I come from. I come from the Bears Ears area. And my mother and my grandfather and my grandmother, they've lived there. They've herd sheep. When they were returned from Fort Sumner, Bosco Redondo, where we were put in that internment camp there, they came back to Bears Ears. And my mom talks about that. She goes, her grandmother told her, she came back from Fort Sumner, and it was in the springtime because there were little goats and little lambs, and that was her job, was to herd these little goats and these little lambs back home. And she would walk behind them and watch their ears flopping and as she took care of them. And that's how she came home. So it was a clean country then. We didn't have uranium. We didn't have oil. As a nurse, all of Angela's life, I've been a nurse.
And today, and most recently, I drive 300 miles a day in the four states of Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. That's my route of helping these uranium workers. They're all men now, and most of them have passed away. And I always, it's emotional for me every time I talk about this, because these are people that I've talked to, that I took care of. They've told me with the last breath that they have. So where are we at now? What did we do? Where are we at? And I can't say where we're at because it's so political, so much bureaucracy. And I just have to tell them, we're working on it. To me, it's like a white lie, you know. But what do you say to a dying person? And they struggle with every breath they have because uranium works that way. It destroys your respiratory. It destroys every part of your body as cancer. And out there with no electricity and no water. And they're supposed to be on oxygen 24/7. And I can't give them the oxygen that they need. The Navajo tribe came up with a solution to do solar panels. Two solar panels at the houses. With that solar panel, you plug in a refrigerator and it sucks it all up. There's nothing to do oxygen 24/7. And they struggle. Not only the old men, but the women. Because those old men have brought that uranium home and they're exposed to it. And now the children. And it's just a vicious cycle. And it's so sad because I can't do anything. And they ask me, what's going on now? And I can't say anything to them. And it's so sad because the breath that they're trying to save, they're asking me these questions and I can't answer them. Him, my mom, she is an advocate. She was a voice for the Bear's Ears, for all of this human destruction that happened, because my dad died from that. And my mom suffered to the very end with her breathing. And like her, and like many other patients that I had to hold her upright, to strain her up to see if they could get another breath. And that, in that last breath, they always had the decency to tell me, thank you. Thank you, my little one, my baby. For washing me. Who does that in their hour of death to give you that thank you? And be thanked that she was so thankful. They were all so thankful, so kind, so polite. And I thought, when I die, I hope I die like that, with dignity, even though it's not for them. But they can still voice that. They can still express that. And it was very heartbreaking. And it still is, because I don't have any resources out there. Today, I would like to see maybe a cancer treatment place in that area, because the nearest hospitals are like 400 miles away in Salt Lake City, 400 miles away in Denver, 400 in Phoenix, nothing close by. That's what I would like to see. And I like to see the government or somebody reach out to the kids, because there's a time frame in there where the uranium workers can get compensation, but it's just them, the ones that worked in the mines, and it doesn't include the children. The children I see today, a lot of cases with leukemia and other deformities, and nothing for the women because they didn't work in there, in those mines either. But the men came home with the yellow cake all over and their on their clothes. The men drank the water in the mines. So that's the work that I do, the work that I did. But I'm still would like to be a voice for my mom, because she was a strong advocate, believed in the bear's ears. She thought that she didn't see the monument come. She died before it became a monument. I speak for my dad, who worked in the mine. My parents don't speak any English. They didn't know what kind of a place they were being sent into. But they worked it during the war so that we couldn't win the war with that uranium. And don't you ever tell me there's a dirty old Indian, because those people gave their lives so that we can be free and walk around in this country. And again, they protected this country with this language that I'm talking to you in as Navajo code talkers. They protected us again to be free here. So hopefully, I hope you walk away, leave here with something tonight of what we're telling you. Where's my handkerchief? Thank you. He's giving me all his handkerchiefs on this trip. Chivalry is not dead. So I could ego being hadist kone di the kayasa anigi bakai honit loni gila is sacred bahasan the yin. When we went out to the ocean, it was so precious, because it's not just the beach that we went to lay out at. We went to a sacred place to look at it, to be there. You don't look at the ocean with human eyes. You look at it in a spiritual eyes, because on top of the water, there are people. There is a house there. And the first lady of our people, she lives there. You look with those spiritual eyes into the water, and there's all the water children in that water. It's another world. It's another world. You look out in the sky, that's another world. We are just in a dimension and a space that is not even ours. It is sacred. It is spiritual. We have songs. And I was fortunate enough to stand at that ocean and hear that song and give it an offering. And thank you, Princeton University, and all of those kids. Those kids are the ones that brought us out here, those students. So somebody's listening, and they're the ones that need to hear it. They need to be the ones to run with this, get a hold of it, and give us some help. And I respect those kids. They came out there, suffered, didn't eat because we don't have any stores. Drove around in the heat, fainting. Yeah, it was very awesome. But And I thank them. I thank Fazil for being out there and understanding that. Fazil, you've done something that cannot be done at the University of Princeton, to be taught again a different way, and you did it. So I appreciate that. And for all of my relatives that I'm with today, And that's how I pray for you, that you will hear us, what's in our heart, what's in our mind, and that's how you're going to see us. And that you will always speak to us with a good spirit, a good voice. Because what is that thing that is inside you? That thing that walks you, talks you, moves you? It's just a spirit. We're all spirit people. And that's how we should treat each other, not destroy it with minerals and ores and radiation. And that's why I oppose mining and other resources that are trying to be dug up over there and then destroying it. The beautiful land where you can heal yourself. You can just go there and sit there, stand there, and you can feel it. It just vibrates, it just absorbs, it seeps into you. That cool stillness in your, it calms your mind, and you can smell the beautiful plants and see the animals there still. That is the healing. That is our temple. That is where we go to church. Everybody has their church where they go to. There's the Holy Lands. Jacob went down to Egypt, and he had that son, Joseph, down there in Egypt. And when he died there, when he was dying there, he told them, don't leave me here. Take me home. And they carried his bones around for years and years until they got back to the Holy Land and buried him there. That was home. That's how you get there. You want to go home to that place you were. This is home to us. This is our holy land. This is our sacred land. Our church, our healing, our food, our home, our way of life. I am there. I am alive with my family, with my relatives, with my people. I will always be there. And that's what I want to share with you.
Thank you. I know that my grandmother was a very outspoken advocate as well, and she believed in the work that we're doing, and she was in the last film that I made with her, and it was about the Bear's Ears and all the work that our communities did, all the tribes going all over the place in Washington, D.C., and going across the country and meeting after meeting and having this historic interaction of all these five tribes forming a coalition, putting all their cultural differences and their past battles beside and working to focus on protecting the sacred land together, which is truly historic. But I value the guidance and the love of my grandmother, my mom, my family members, my relatives. And this is truly a collective endeavor. And it's a place we've never been before on a level that we only had a glimpse of when we first started. And so this is an area where we're just trying to make the good path by walking it. And we're doing that as the best that we can all together as family. And I know someone else who has that same kind of struggle. It's my my daughter here, Tara. Because I know one of our UDB board members is her mother, Mary. And she does quite a bit of work with her as well, going back and forth and advocating together, traveling, doing a lot of work in partnership in a lot of ways. And she also has her own children, and she's a mother, and she's has that intergenerational experience of what this work is like. And so I wanted to ask you about that, Tara. What is that like to have, your mother, your children, and, teaching other kids as well, as you often do in your community, and talking about this protection of traditional knowledge and land? Why is that important?
Yate, can you hear me? Che Tara Benalin, Shia. Yakinin Shlo, but Anidashanessa. Ash Che Bashishin, Oge Dashanella, being betorne Dashache. Hi, my name is Tara Benali. I'm of Hopi descent, raised by a Bitani clan, a Navajo Bitani clan, born for the Navajo Ashi clan. My grandmas and my grandpas are Navajo, the Reed people and the Deer Spring people. Why it means so much to me is while I was growing up on the reservation, I had basically two identities. One thing was that we are of Hopi descent, and we were raised on Navajo. And years passed, Hopi and Navajo had disagreements. There were things that they disagreed upon. Well, so many years forward, a year ago, I met with John Curtis in Washington, D.C. I sat down and talked to him about public lands, the Bears Ears National Monument, and he said to me, Hopi has no business with Bears Ears. The Pueblos have no business. The Zunis have no business with Bears Ears. And I says, wait a minute. That is exactly where you are wrong. I am of Hopi. My family, my people is Hopi. And so is Navajo. So we have every right to have a say in the Bears Ears National Monument. Because those are my people. Those are my ancestors whose writing is on the wall. That was their home. And why it's important to me is because I want the youth of our community to understand. 3 years ago when I first got involved with Yutat Nabekeya, and let me tell you, 3 years ago, I said I never ever want to have anything to do to deal with political stuff, the advocacy of the land. I never wanted to deal with the chapters, anything political I didn't want to deal with. I was a construction worker, first and foremost, and that's what I did coming out of high school. And I retired about 4 years ago from construction, and I had a year in between there, and my mom became a board member for the Yutat Nabekeya, who was responsible for the Bears Ears National Monument. Well, one of these community outreach that I was doing with Jonah and Cynthia, she's on one of these slides as well, we were meeting with a group of youth out of Halchita, sitting there and talking to them about what Bears Ears meant to us and why it was important to reach out to the youth and for them to understand was the fact that it was their identity. So many times I see our youth lost. They're dying from suicide. They're becoming addicts of different forms. And growing up, I had so many identities. I had the Hopi identity. I had the Navajo identity. I had the traditional teachings from my grandmother, but the church teachings from my parents. And having to make those work was a struggle for me. And so I had so many identities that I didn't know what to do with. So finally, I've come full circle when my Yaj here, Willie Gray Eyes, said, you know what? At one of his meetings in White Mesa, he said, Bears Ears is about healing. And I said, okay, this is what we need. This is what the people need. This is where I need to be. And then after my brother, my Yaj was done talking, my brother, Mark Maraboy, stood and said, you know what? Bears Ears is not only about healing. It's about the prayer that we asked of the community members far and wide to pray for us to make this possible. And within that year, Bears Ears became a monument. So a lot of the community outreach that we did were to the elders because we needed to hear their stories to make it possible for the government, the federal government, to understand why it was important. For me, it was for teaching the kids, the youth, because I know we were losing them. I could see it in their eyes. And at this event, at this community outreach that we did in Holchita, Utah, and I was talking to them while Jonah and Cynthia were getting the watercolors and the art stuff that they were going to do with the kids, and I was telling them, you know what? Bears Ears is who you are. It's what makes you. This is your home. Don't ever let anybody tell you that you're nobody. Don't ever tell yourself that you're nobody. Because my grandmother, four generations back, was born north of Bears Ears. And she went on the long walk at a very young age. And having her to go through the long walk and people just try to take her identity away, she came home. She came back to that area and settled and started her family there. And so it's important for me, for the youth, when I was talking to them that summer in Holchita, and to tell them that this is who you are. Our families came home, our ancestors came home, our elders came home from the long walk and settled here. And just seeing that I was able to touch 3 or 4 out of 12, 15 kids, that meant that I touched those kids. Because they finally found and heard who they are. And I reach out to the youth nowadays because they're getting the education that we need back home to help us in this effort that we're putting together, that we have put together, that we have made possible. For you to learn that all you can and to bring it home to us. Like my mom said here, we need this facilities for our uranium workers who are suffering from cancer and sickness. We need the education that you can provide us back home. Our people need it. I also work for a nonprofit organization where we are doing voter registration and addressing for the nation. Sitting there and having to listen to community members and to hear their stories, their wants and their needs. And it's like she said, you know, the pipeline, the water line just ends like 500 feet away from their home, and yet it's still not piped into their homes. Or the electricity line that just runs half a mile down the road where they could easily get extended to their homes. It hasn't happened yet. We need your education, your strength, and your to meet us halfway. That is my wish, and that is why I advocate for the people. Because you can do it. Just like we have started something for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tara. Yeah. Oh, no. Thank you. As you can see, I come from a strong line of women. But that is many of our indigenous communities. They are our leaders. They are our culture carriers. They are life givers. And I'm really honored to be, you know, part of this this fine collection of not just family members but people. You know, they're great human beings, and they're doing good work in so many different areas. And as she pointed out, she's also Hopi. And I'm also Hopi and Navajo, so I guess technically there's 3 Pueblos up here on stage now. Is that some kind of record? I don't know. Because like yesterday, it was only me and Tara, so we're like, oh, I guess we're the only Pueblos here at Princeton. But now we're lucky. We got really bumped it up now with Ajani. So, and Ajani is hailing from Jemez Pueblo. and she's doing great work as a Pueblo Community Outreach Coordinator. And her organization and her ability to reach out to those communities and bring them back to the ancestral homelands of the Bears Ears has been amazing. I've watched the transformation before my eyes, seeing these communities and these people coming back to their ancestral places, and just that it's like instinct, blood memory is coming back like that. And it's incredible. So I wanted to ask Ajani a little bit about this. What is the role that you think that having the Pueblo kind of history, culture, and the perspective, and as a woman, like for doing this land protection work about Bears Ears?
I'm sorry, can you say the question again?
Well, I just wanted to, you know, elaborate a little bit more on the Pueblo perspective as you see it as a Pueblo woman doing this work for Bears Ears.
Okay. Eno a seo mo ni bao agito hi walato eseo e sont at the mio cat to ma qiu e pekke sewagi the kimio the kumio. Hi, my name is Ajani Yepa. I am from the Pueblo of Jemez. In New Mexico, which is, you know, one of the four corner states. I am not of Diné, so that was a different language dialect that that y'all have heard tonight. So, my role and journey in this work is deeply personal, just like each of these women here that I've had the really honor of sharing this panel with. And thank you for all of the work that's been done. And I'm the newest member to the team as well. So I'm sort of, you know, these women here to my, you know, on this panel that I'm with, I've really invested so much of themselves into this, and so I just wanted to thank you each and acknowledge you, and thank you for letting me like be here too. And for me, my connection, we are further displaced, I guess, removed from that area of the Bears Ears in the Four Corners. The Pueblos of New Mexico are all along the Rio Grande Valley, a little bit out west toward Gallup. And the distance of our migration has spanned, you know, it's about a 4-hour drive, but it's been, you know, a 10,000-year migration into the area and regions that we're in now. And these are our homelands. Like, all of the ancestral structures and the ancestral sites that you see belong to different and various Pueblo communities. Hopi and Zuni, who are officially in the Coalition of Tribes, but there's additionally 20 more Pueblos in New Mexico that have ancestral ties to this space as well. And so I'm from one of those communities who hasn't yet been, you know, had a seat at officially at the table. But regardless, these spaces and places are still like very, very sacred to us. And regardless of that distance of time and space, our ceremonies and pilgrimages have always been maintained, returning back into these Bears Ears. And it's not something that we share very freely or frequently or openly because of the trauma and impacts of colonization. And having to go to take our ceremonies and our songs and dances into secret. And so because of that, we carry out those pilgrimages and that return home. It's not something that's very well known even for like our whole communities. It's just for the individuals and folks that need to do those ceremonies. And so my outreach really has been about reconnecting myself personally, but also to sharing that with people in my community, that this place really is our ancestral homeland. I remember, oh my gosh, I remember the first time that I got to go out there, and the first time I visited one of the ancestral structures or one of the sites, and the familiarity, it's undeniable. You know, in New Mexico, like, the Pueblos were very vibrant, alive people. We, you know, practice our culture and our ceremonies all the time, and I grew up with that. I understand those things. That's who, a part of who I am. That is who I am. That is who I am. And to see this place, right, like, two state lines away, behind all of these other like monument designations, and then to go there into a kiva, into like a home, and to see the markings on the walls, recognizing those patterns and those symbols and those markings, and knowing we still use those every day in our community. It's really undeniable that we have that connection there. And so, you know, as Tara mentioned, you know, representatives in the state of Utah want to say that Pueblos don't have a connection to that place, but it's because of those imagined lines across the land that were never there before, that they believe in, that tells them that we're separate from that. But we know, and we've always maintained, that is our home, that is our place, that is a space, it's a sacred space. I mean, I see these places on the cliff, and it's like they're still alive. You could still hear the sound of, you know, the flint working. You could still hear the women gossiping and laughing. You can still, you know, hear the children running and playing. You could, it's these places are alive. I had the opportunity to go up a few weeks ago, and I harvested some cedar from the top of one of the hills. And I sat there with the plant with my relative, and I had this moment where I realized, here I am, and it's 2019, and here I am with these medicines, and these are the same medicines that fed my ancestors, that provided that nourishment and that healing for them, and that how lucky and blessed I am to share that same medicine with those same ancestors of the medicine that fed my ancestors. And it's very, it is home. When Curtis was talking about that feeling of home, it's healing. It really is. It makes you feel whole again. And when I went and I saw and I felt that, to realize that the reason why we don't have access to that, the reason why we don't get to go openly and freely, and we have to hide in secret to do these things, the reason why our whole community can't embrace this place as home, are because of all of these layers of oppression and colonization that have been laid on us, and that even we, you know, our distance from this place, from that. And so my goal in my work is really just to return, or to share that feeling that I have of home when I go there, how happy I am, how great things, you know, how the world can be, and to share that with more public people, and help more of our people come home, because it's a yearning. It's something inside that, it's something that we all need as people, is that connection to the land. And so just to help people return home, that's something I hope for our future and for my daughter. So.
All right, thank you, Ajani. So, you know, there's a lot of struggle, a lot of obstacles, but I think that underlying all of this, really the message is about healing. It's about recognizing that through all these challenges that we can overcome them, and we have. Like, we got a monument. We technically still have it. It hasn't been decided in court yet, right? So for us, we just know that that place is special and important and worthy of protection, and we are going to be there, designation or not, legality or not, United States or not. That's home, and we're going to protect it. And it's not just about healing of the land and the people, even though that's what it's about. It's also the historical trauma that needs healing. And so this place is more than just a place. It's the future. It's the past and the present and the future all in one. And it has huge potential for healing for all of us. So join me in thanking them for giving us a great panel tonight. Thank you.
So before we move on with the next component of our program, I would just like to once again thank the panelists for sharing their courage and strength and wisdom with all of us, and also to have everybody think about the kind of stories that they're offering as a call to action, so that we also consider our own political responsibilities in all of these issues as we move forward. So next on our program, I have the honor of introducing Kiana Dishface, who is Blue Mountain Diné, a sophomore in high school, and Miss Blue Mountain Unity. So please join me in welcoming her.
Okay. Yat e shik edo shidane, dots anoso she ya ki wanna dish face in a she. A shlushin a shlong, last year, bushishin, kinatini dash nele, our dog, last year, dishache. Shimato shija e the quinta jando, Calvin Dishface Junior will ya. Shichedo smasana e Stanley Dominique John will ya. Shnella dosh nele estan, e Calvin Dishface Senior, who yanet e dol nele dishface will ya. Miss Bima and Unity, naki de miliaja dobo ante vit ada, dol naki de miliaja nas et ada nishle. Hasant ada eshinache. Samon hai de inch tagi. Musta do teth a cheat that's gonna add det nasha. So, hello everybody. I am Kiwana Dishface. I am currently in the 10th grade and I go to school at Samon High in Blanding, Utah. I am the current Miss Wan Unity 2018 and 2019, and I'm glad to be here. Today I'm gonna be telling you guys a story. It's like a story about weaving, and I myself can weave, but I'm still like in the learning process of learning how to weave. But I have grandmas and aunties that do know how to weave, and in matter of fact, I have a great grandma whose Navajo rug is, I think, in Germany in a museum. And this story is about a lady, her name's Changing Woman, and another lady, our grandmas, like our Native American people, our grandma, our Navajo people actually, our grandma, Spider Woman. So Changing Woman, one day she was walking along, and as a curious woman as she was, she saw like a little hole in the ground, and it was a spider hole. And she knew it was someone's home, and she knew that she wanted to see what it was. So she didn't call down or anything. She decided to, like, peek inside just to see, like, what was in there. And she was as she peeked inside, she saw Spider-Woman sitting at her loom. She was like weaving, and she had like all these tools beside her, and she was just really curious. So she looked, and then as the sun went down, she looked all day, and the sun went down, she went home. But then she came back, and she looked again, and she was so curious, and she was fascinated by the things the Spider-Woman was doing. And she went back for 4 days. So the first day is when she found it, and then the last day, Spider-Woman was weaving. And then she finally said, "What do you want? Why are you here?" And then Changing Woman was shocked. She was like, "Oh, you see me?" And Spider-Woman was like, "Yeah, I can see your shadow." And Changing Woman was like kind of scared, like, "Oh, I probably shouldn't be peeking at this. It's probably bad. I probably shouldn't be doing this." But Spider-Woman was like, "Come down, granddaughter." And Spider-Woman was shocked. She was like, "How am I supposed to fit in this little hole?" She was like, she didn't know what to do, but then all of a sudden the hole grew bigger, and she grew a little bit smaller, and she was able to fit in the hole. She went inside, and Spider-Woman welcomed her in. She was like, "Okay, well now why were you watching me, and are you interested, or what were you doing?" And so then Changing Woman said, "Well, I'm very interested in what you're doing. I am fascinated by what you're doing, and I want to know more." So Spider-Woman said, "Well, I'm going to tell you this, but if I tell you this, you're going to have to use it for your good. Use it for the good, and just keep using it, and use it to help heal yourself, to help keep up your spirits, and to help provide." Spider-Woman said, she had her loom, and she was like, "This my husband makes." She was naming all the parts of the loom, of the Navajo loom, and she's like, "But this," she grabbed the yarn, she's like, "This is what I make. I make it from my silk, of my, the silk I make." But then she's like, "But you can make it by yourself. You can make it from the sheep wool, and you get the sheep wool, and you card it, and then you get it, and you keep carding it until it's soft enough and fluffy enough, then you make it into yarn. You, like, roll it up, then you get, like, your spinner, and you roll it, and you roll it," and she made yarn. And she's like, "You can make it different colors, too. You can use plants, you can use all your resources, and you can use water, and you can make your colors." And she was like, "But this," and she was telling her story of how she found her loom and how she decided to make it and how her people knew about it. And she was like, "But if I give it to you, you're going to have to provide." So now Native Americans today and people all over the world use a loom to provide for money, for food, for all their needs. And they use it for, like, to help heal, and they use it and they put their special patterns and symbols on the loom for certain things. So, that's my story, and that's what I use, and I use it, my rugs, for healing. I use it for my people. So that's my story. Thank you.
So next on our program, the next portion of our program will be with Willie Gray Eyes, San Juan County Commissioner, who will be interviewed by Honor Keeler, who is from the Cherokee Nation and Assistant Director of Utah Diné Pekea.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming tonight. I'd like to call up Willie Gray Eyes for an interview here. And he is the commissioner of San Juan County, and I have great respect for him as a former chairperson at Utah Diné Pekea. And he has been, along with the elders in the committee, in UDB, a visionary. I think for Bears Ears and for the people of that region. And I'm going to interview him tonight to talk about a few issues, one of which is healing. And we've heard today from a lot of the speakers about the history of the Delaware people here in Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Northern Delaware, and removal. We've heard also about the long walk that the Diné people experienced and were able to come back to their homelands. And we've heard quite a bit about what survival has been for many of our peoples. And in particular, We heard from Ida Yellowman, Angelo's mother, also about the landscape and how that's a healing place and how that's kind of similar to the concept of a church. And so my question to Willie tonight has a lot to do with that history. And we're here now in this room together. What can we do all together as the peoples? And what can be done about this history that's occurred to Indigenous peoples?
First of all, I'd like to welcome everybody. Xehe, thank you very much. Xehe means thank you in Navajo. Yat e means hello, an open heart, greeting. Yat e. Can anybody say that? Yat e? Right. Good. I got some Navajos in here. Similar like a canyon wall on each side, sitting in the wash somewhere in the desert. Would it be? Imagination? There's a canyon right here, canyon walls. So in that sense, the question seems to be that my thinking and my understanding, my learning has over the years. I'm a young man. You're just imagining. Right? Right. Okay. In that sense, the question relates to how can we handle a situation that has been created, imposed. It's not that we were in participation, we were left out in the dark, so to speak, in terms of right now, they always say, come back together, talk. In Navajo, we always say, come back together. If there's an argument between two parties, talk it out. Rather than going to court. Court is an adversarial approach to disagreement or the resolution of disagreement. One person will be put down or hurt. The other one will be raised to the top and say, yes, I won. That's adversarial. The Navajo approach was, at the time that I was a kid, is called a sensible resolution, is to have the people come together and talk it out. In terms, if they don't come together to talk it out, they're sort of like a mediator. Not only by themselves, but a whole community people will participate. So everybody knows what is transpiring behind, let's say, closed door, that has happened, that has hurt somebody. So in that sense, public participation is to have recommendation to talk things out in the end, people will shake hands, people will cry on each other's shoulder and go home smiling, rather than the court system type. You've seen all of it, here and there. I've been through it. So in that sense, that's what's needed. Peacemaking. That's what we call peacemaking approach. Navajo peacemaking approach. To resolve difference. That's not practiced anywhere other than the Navajo Nation today. And for some time, I've been trying to instill that into a system with one of the lawyers that has been at work with it. And I was the on the Navajo Nation Judiciary Committee. And that's where we developed some of these techniques, and it has worked. Not at the high cost, but only time and energy and commitment. How to resolve personal conflicts. Thank you.
I think in an earlier conversation, you had also been talking to me about what the country could do in the future for Indigenous peoples in the form of perhaps some other things that they've done in Japan after conflict.
I thought you were going to say, what can you do for the country, and what can the country do for you? In that sense. My take was that why has the United States federal government or any of its local government, the states, recognize and present a formal apology to the Native Americans that had all the things of the negative impact that has been imposed on them. For instance, like my chief from Delaware, removal. It's not just removal. It's forced removal. It's like in the movies, they used to take herd of cattle from Texas to Kansas. That is forced removal of animals. In that same sense, we were, as Native American, were forced removed from our attached psychological, spiritual attachment and sociological and environmental attachment to the land. So they were savored in terms of relocation. So they did a written apology to Japan. Why not to the United States of America, Native Americans? Why hasn't that happened? It might precipitate a lot of healing. Just like Navajos were the luckiest tribe that were removed and known as the Long Walk. They came from the Bear's Ears all the way to borderline of Texas and New Mexico. Some say 350 miles, probably from Bear's Ears. A lot of them were over close to 500 miles. Imagine just walking, carrying a load of survival tools and food, being forced. And that's the type of treatment that we have received. And I think the spirituality part of the Navajo people, to my understanding, was they prayed day and night, day and night. Even though they were forced to build a shelter into the ground to make the winter winds a little more happy than sharp on them. So those times, food was scarce. And even then, food was scarce. They have to go out to the corral to the dropping of those horses and spread those manures to pick up all the kernels that had not been digested in order to survive on those. That's the extent of the treatment that we receive. So that's the type of mentality that has gone generation to generation to generation to generation. 1868 to this day. And still people remember exactly what has happened. And they themselves are internalizing these things. A lot of them went to the next homeland without having to receive apology or appropriate and proper treatment of their problems. To this day, we're still feeling that. Not only a psychological impact, also the spiritual impact. So that is my perspective in terms of understanding how these things are working. Even right now, the government, down to from the United States federal government to the state of Utah to Arizona and New Mexico, they are not willing to say, here, let me put my hand on your head and pray to heal you. So that is my understanding.
Hello, Willie. You know, this, we've talked a lot tonight, I think, about trauma and what's happened to our peoples collectively. You know, something I always say, and I hope that all of you here tonight, as you're listening and as you're leaving, for every place that you go to and you walk upon here in the United States and Canada, Central and South America, and elsewhere in the world, that you ask, whose lands do I stand upon? Who has been here since time immemorial? Who are the peoples and what is this history? And I hope that you'll all at some point be able to join us out at Bears Ears and see what that land is like. Willie, do you have any closing remarks?
In that sense, the traumas that's imposed or inflicted on the Native American across the country, to my understanding, Native Americans were in the thousands, tens of thousands, making up North America, United States, Central America, and South America. You ask an archaeologist, and they will tell you what kind of findings they have. Where did they go? There's only 576 recognized, federally recognized tribes right now in the United States. What happened to the tens and tens of thousands of Native Americans that were here before what they called discovery? I don't think it was a discovery. I think it was an incident that happened that they call discovery. The guy that sailed was lost on the sea. And to all that matters, that's what they called discovery. So to us, it's not discovery. Who discovered? We discovered them coming offshore. For all the help that we gave on Thanksgiving Day, they turn around and blow our heads off. Literally. Those are some of the things later on, the Land Resource, Land Act, taking Native American lands away by assigning them, even though they knew that Native American doesn't have the money to pay for the tax. So in that sense, if you don't pay your tax on your property is taken. You lose your homeland. Where do you go? That's the question I have. Where do you go? Nobody answers that. If you lose the land, I don't know who would answer that. But that's the type of thing that I'm still learning about, wrestling with it in terms of what they call assimilation, boarding school. 9 months out of a year, a detachment. So today, those parents that went to distant boarding schools are having these parent-child relationship problems. A pattern of problems that was imposed on us. And finally, somebody woke up in Washington or somewhere, I don't know where, and they say, oh, Indian children should go to school within their own community. That's reversal of the whole concept of boarding school, 5-year program, and there was another program called relocation. Relocation was when these long-distance boarding school student graduated, they were placed in Chicago, they were placed in Salt Lake City, they were placed in California, so they can become white. Their thinking pattern to be changed. Their understanding, and they'll say, okay, I don't need my language. I don't need my Indian thinking pattern. So they throw it away. That was the approach and understanding. But nevertheless, Indians are survival. They kept their language, they kept their thinking pattern, they kept their vision, they kept their belief intact. So you find an Indian in Japan, Navajo, what will they say when you locate? Hare Shnanna, the language that won World War II. And they'll say, Wunderat, Khatish, the Nandle, what clan are you? To establish that connection, these two Navajos that have never seen each other, in Navajo will connect each other by clan system. So there's always, everywhere in Navajo, you are related to somebody. All you need to ask them is what clan you are. And there you have a family. In behavioral health, they say, they lose themselves. And they said, my family doesn't want me anymore, so they chased me off. So I started drinking. But they don't know that their clan system in place, and they have the whole Navajo Nation as a family. So that's the way we address each other. My Che, right here. My grandmother, right here. And my other Che over here. There's another Che, my grandfather's. All of these people are my grandfather. My mom is right here. Mom, stand up. See, that's my mother. Even though I have gray hair, I respect my mother. See, that's the type of thinking, lateral thinking, is opposed to circular thinking. Navajo, we're always thinking in circles. Because we know where we came from, and we know where we will go after our end is completed. Just like the Bible says, you came from the dust, you will go back to the dust. That's the way the Navajos think also. Thank you very much. Your turn.
Yes. So I'd again like to thank Willie Gray Eyes and Honor Keeler for sharing that with us, and for actually doing some of the important work of restoring or retelling the history of the United States, which is obviously actively erased from most curriculum in public schools and something that most of us aren't exposed to when we take social studies classes and history classes when we're wrong. So it's really important to always think through the kind of history that we're taught and to listen to people that can tell us that we can learn from about the truth about the founding of the United States, which I agree, Willie, was not discovery. So as we're nearing the end of our program, I'd like to invite Jonah Yellowman, who is Dene and Utah Dene Bekea's spiritual advisor, up to offer the closing prayer. And remember, no photography, media of any kind. Thank you, Jonah, for opening and closing this event in a good way. And also, I'd like to say thank you again to Curtis, too, for reminding us of our responsibilities here in Philadelphia and thinking hard about the history of the place and the land that we have made our homes on for those of us that live in this area. So we're going to close tonight with a few words from Eduardo Cadava, professor of English at Princeton University. So he's going to offer the closing statement. And I would just, before we end, like to also thank all these incredible community leaders and advocates and spiritual leaders for coming to Philadelphia and for sharing everything that you know and all the work that you do. It's incredibly humbling and always a really important learning experience for me. And I look forward to being able to have a chance to visit you and to support your work as best I can from Philadelphia and New York. So thank you for being here. Thanks for coming, everyone.
I'm a professor at Princeton, but I'm also the president of the executive board of SLOT. And on behalf of SLOT, I want to add my thanks to Aaron's. So I want to thank you all for coming here. I want to thank our dear Fazel for everything he did to make this visit possible. And I want to thank our very special and distinguished guests. We're very honored to have you all with us. I say this often, but I believe this, that one of the most precious things that a person can give another person is their time. So I want to thank you all for your time. Your time and presence, I can assure you, is registered as the gift that it has been. So thank you very much for this. I also want to thank all of those of you who welcomed this little group that went to go visit you in Princeton, from Princeton to Utah. It was kind of amazing for all of us to be there, and I just want to tell you that we will carry the experiences we had, your generosity, your welcome with us always. Thank you very much. I hope you all come back soon to visit us again. And in the meantime, I hope that all of you who are here take everything that you heard this evening and witnessed this evening as a call to responsibility and as an invitation to do everything you can to help protect Bears Ears and other sacred lands, and as an invitation also to begin to imagine what the world would look like if we were all able to learn the lessons we were offered so generously this evening. Thank you very much for being here. While you're socializing a little bit, Jimerson Tsotsi and Will Benali will play for us some music. Please help me welcome Jimerson and Will.